G'day, I'm Philip Adams. Almost had you. And you'll get your program of choice in just a moment. This is just me, Jonathan Green, saying you might also like the Sunday Extra podcast. We're on the RN website too.
Hello and welcome to Books and Arts Daily, coming to you today from the Adelaide Writers' Week. I'm Michael Cathcart. Thanks for joining us. And we're in the gracious Elder Hall at Adelaide University with an enthusiastic audience. And they're here because they bought tickets to meet Tom Holland. Tom is that rare creature, a best-selling historian. He has a flair for combining scholarship with evocative storytelling. And he has the courage to take on the big stories. The fall of the Roman Empire, the clash between the Persians and the Greeks, and the great surge of battles around the first millennium, which he calls the forging of Christendom. Now he's written his most controversial book, In the Shadow of the Sword, The Battle for Global Empire and the End of the Ancient World. It's a history of the rise of the Arabs in the 7th century, and of how they conquered the Middle East and brought an end to the imperial might of both the Persians and the Romans. So why is this controversial? Well, because along the way, Holland questions whether these triumphant Arabs were Muslims. Islam, he says, did not inspire this mighty act of conquest. Islam came later. This claim calls into question the Muslim view of where the religion came from. It severs the bonds that link Muhammad to Mecca and to the formulation of the Quran. And Holland, not surprisingly, has made a lot of people very cross. The Muslim response to his claims got really hostile in August last year when Channel 4 in the UK broadcast his documentary all about this, which is called Islam, the Untold Story. A mass audience heard what he'd been saying in print, and around 1,000 people lodged complaints with Channel 4 or the government's official regulator of broadcasting, and Channel 4 cancelled a repeat telecast of the show. Tom, welcome to Books and Arts at Adelaide Writers' Week.
Thank you very much.
So let's get to know you first. You're an historian of the ancient world. Where did that interest begin?
Well, I think it began right back in my childhood, because before I became interested in ancient history, I was interested in prehistory. So dinosaurs, of course, like all boys, but also ancient mammals and the whole spread of prehistoric creatures. So the first, for instance, that I knew of Australia, before I knew about Sydney or cricket or Kylie, what I knew about was the prehistoric marsupials that lived here, because I had a book of prehistoric animals and it showed me the full range of creatures that had once roamed in Australia. And being here in Adelaide, I've been to the museum and looked at the skeletons today, and it's been an incredible treat.
Those are the childhood questions. What are the questions that were preoccupying you as you embarked on university study?
Well, I should really say how I got from my childhood obsession with prehistoric creatures to university studies.
Okay.
Because essentially, I think it was the sort of what appealed to me both about dinosaurs and about Romans was the sort of glamour of violence that they both have. Dinosaurs and Romans, to my childhood way of thinking, were fierce, exciting, and extinct. And I think that not to exaggerate, it was that sort of sense of just how ferocious and how terrifying and yet how compellingly fascinating the Romans were. And just cumulatively, I found that I was vastly more interested in empires and worlds the more ancient that they were. And I found that this interest in antiquity is one that has grown up with me. So that I began with this sort of childhood obsession, and then through my teens, you know, as I was sort of discovering the pangs of first love, I had Catullus to hold my hand. And then into the 20s and 30s, I found that as I experienced the world, again, the sort of, you know, the classical world was keeping me company. Because I think the fascination of it for those of us in the West is that in Western Europe, certainly, we had two cracks at civilization. The implosion of the classical world in Western Europe was far profounder than anything that happened in China or India or even the Middle East. And so there is that sense of a sort of firewall between us and antiquity. And I think it has something of the appeal of a very good science fiction. Because when you look at the Greeks or the Romans, they're like us, but they're also fantastically alien. And it's that sort of tension between what is familiar and what is very, very strange that I think is the explanation for why people have always been fascinated by them.
Now, I take it from what I've read that you're an atheist, and a great deal of your writing about the past concerns the relationships between people and the gods. So you must have considered why people feel the need to believe in God.
I wouldn't say that I'm atheist. I would say I'm a sort of a fuzzy Anglican, which would equate to agnosticism. My father was atheist, but my mother was devoutly Anglican, and I was brought up in an Anglican tradition, and I suppose that my religious sensibility, insofar as I have one, is Christian. But there were complicating factors. One was that the appeal of the Greek gods to me was very strong. I think if I absolutely had to choose a god to worship, it would probably be Athena. And the other problem was that of course, the Old Testament in particular is deeply problematic as history. And the moment you start reading the Old Testament and comparing it with what we know about the history of the Near East, all kind of problems sort of start rearing their head. So there was always that tension between religious belief and what history tells us.
So you're buying into a fearsome debate here that goes back 100 years, in which Christian scholars have infuriated Muslim scholars by doubting the origins of the Quran. Can you outline the shape of that debate as it was before you came along?
Well, as I said, there are all kinds of tensions in the study of the Bible, essentially from the 18th through the 19th and then an escalating degree into the 20th century. The process by which scholars looked at the Bible not as a text that originated in the will of God, but as an ancient text like any other, has meant that the process of historicizing Christianity and the archaeology and the history of the Old Testament has meant that the tension is there, and I think that by and large Jews and Christians would accept that. Partly, I think, because that tradition of looking at biblical texts and the origins of Judaism and Christianity skeptically emerges out of Jewish and Christian intellectual traditions. With Islam, it's different because for Muslims, the Quran is the holiest thing that there is. It's what Jesus is to Christians. It's the intrusion of the divine into the earthly. And so there's never really been a tradition within Islam of looking at the Quran and asking, well, what if it's not the word of God? What if it's just a text like any other? And Christian and Jewish scholars in the 19th century did start to do that. But I think because Islam wasn't a main focus for Western scholars, it didn't really monopolize attention. But what's happened over the past 30, 40 years, of course, is that Islam has developed a greater saliency in the West. And so correspondingly, scholars want to know, well, where does it come from? How do we identify it? How do we explain it as a historical phenomenon? And so the kind of tension that existed between Christians and Jews and skeptical inquiry in the 19th century has now started to rear its head in the late 20th and early 21st century. And I hadn't really appreciated that when I began writing about it, because what I wanted to know was why the Roman Empire had fallen in the East, because the Arabs get their empire in part by dismembering the Roman Empire and just leaving this sort of bleeding trunk, and swallowing up the Persian Empire, this great, vast dominion, swallowing it up whole like a sort of boa constrictor gulping down a goat. And what I wanted to know, well, how did this happen? And to do that, of course, I then had to start looking at the origins of Islam as a historical phenomenon.
So it's pretty clear, looking at your other work, the way your mind worked. You're trawling through the ancient world, looking for the big stories, and you found a big story with the Greeks, the big story with the Persians, and now you've got this big story, which is the surge of the Arabs, and suddenly you're in this deep water that you hadn't anticipated.
There is something exciting about great empires that fall. It is an inherently haunting and dramatic. And the more that I studied the Greeks and the Romans, wrote one book about the Romans, one book about the Greeks, so the more I wanted to know why did they fall? Yeah. Where did it go?
Well,
what happened?
Let's tell the audience what the key event here is. So in the television documentary, you've got a great television line. You say, in the year 636, God changed his mind. That's a wonderful television line. So the key event is the Muslim overthrow of Constantinople. God has changed his mind about who he's backing.
Well, Arab overthrow.
Okay, yes, that's
and
your
you
point.
See, this is the huge problem with dealing with this period, is that words like Muslim, Christian, Jew, don't have the resonance and don't have the meaning that they now have. And so when you use a word like Christianity or Islam and you apply it to the 7th or the 8th centuries, you have to be very careful, because I don't think that they have yet taken on the precise signification that they have
now.
So
as I read what you're arguing, it's that there's a kind of great spiritual soup in that part of the world, and there are things that look a bit like something you'd recognise as being from Christianity, and something you could now say that to Judaism and so on, but that there are sacred texts and religions kind of swirling around.
I think that it's a transformation that takes centuries. I was talking about my interest in why and how the ancient cast of mind changed, and I think basically it is down to monotheism. It's down to the ethical and moral revolution that what becomes Judaism, what becomes Christianity, and what becomes Islam represents. But that process takes a very long time, and it takes a long time for what we would now recognize as Christianity to emerge, for a definitive set of doctrines and structures to be established.
So when would
and
you
basically,
say...
Well, basically what happens is that Constantine has his vision, decides that he's going to back a particular faction of the church, and with the muscle of the Roman Empire behind it, this church is able then to establish itself as orthodox. And everything then follows on from that, because once Christianity has established itself and the leaders of the church can set up sort of frontiers and barriers around the perimeter to keep the faithful in and to keep the heretics out, then everyone else has to start doing that as well.
And
it's also a sort of escalation.
And also the theology's been codified in a way we would still recognise as leading to us.
Yes, so what had previously been sort of points on a bandwidth, so at one extreme you have Christians who think that the God of the Old Testament is the devil, and at the other end you have rabbis who think that Jesus is in hell being boiled in a bucket of excrement. What happens is that barriers go up between, say, Christians and Jews. And so as the Christian church crystallizes, so rabbinical Judaism crystallizes as well. And so these two form rival sort of camps, and the no man's land between them becomes increasingly awkward. So what happens to the people who are inhabiting this no man's land, this land where, for instance, Christians who follow the Jewish law or Jews who think that Jesus was the Messiah, where do they go? And I think the answer is that the greatest concentration of these people obviously lies in the Holy Land, because that is sacred both to Jews and to Christians. When the Roman Empire becomes Christian, it starts to force these heretics out into the desert. And so I think absolutely you have this sort of melting pot, this soup of different doctrines and heresies and beliefs that is bubbling away on the limits of Roman Palestine. And that continues to be a center for heresies that elsewhere in the Christian world, these have vanished. And I think that that is the likeliest place for the beginnings of Islam.
This is Books and Arts Daily on RN, coming to you from Adelaide Writers' Week, and we're talking to Tom Holland about his controversial views about the origin of Islam. So let's just lay out what the conventional account is of how and where the Quran was revealed to Muhammad and how Islam came into being, and then look more carefully at your critique of that.
So the traditional account is that Muhammad is an illiterate merchant in a city called Mecca, which is basically in the middle of nowhere. This city, it's represented as being a great cult center. It's pagan. There are no Jews or Christians there. When he is 40, Muhammad gets, hears a voice, and it's the voice of an angel. And this angel is giving him revelations direct from God. And Muhammad is the seal of the prophets. He is the last in a great line of prophets stretching back to Adam. And because he is preaching a form of monotheism, a belief in a single God, this offends the people of Mecca, who depend for their livelihood on their pagan cult center. And so Muhammad and his followers are forced to flee to another city called Yathrib, which becomes the city or Medina of the Prophet. And there, Muhammad's revelations, his prestige, his military success, all combine to make him a figure of immense status across Arabia. And by the end, he has seized control back of Mecca, and all of Mecca, all of Arabia, has become Muslim.
Now, these revelations from the angel Gabriel happened over the 23 years of his life.
Yes.
He didn't write things down because he couldn't.
Yeah.
He remembered it. So he gets the divine word in installments, learns it, and then passes it on to other people who also learn it. That's the argument, isn't it? That's the claim.
Yes. It is claimed by Muslims that he delivers many sayings that get memorized and get passed down the generations. And after Muhammad's death, the Arabs, who have now become Muslim, who have inherited Islam in exactly the form that we have it now, are inspired by his teachings to erupt from the depths of the desert, and the hand of God is evident in the fact that they overthrow these two very ancient and very powerful empires, first the Roman and then the Persian. So a vast empire is established, and the fact that they've established this vast empire is the proof of the fact that Muhammad is indeed the prophet of God.
So that's why you were insistent earlier on that you want to call it the Arab conquest,
yes.
Whereas the traditional view is, or the orthodox view, is that it's a Muslim conquest.
I'm not convinced that they are Muslim.
Yes, that's what you call into question, that they're not actually Muslim because Islam comes later. So you talk about the eerie silence that seems to shroud the origins of Islam. And I want you to explain that position to me in greater detail, because you've got a difficult job to pull off as a historian, because you're arguing that there is an absence. And it's always very difficult to base an argument on the claim that something is not there, because the retort to you is, look, something was there. There was an oral tradition. Yes, people did write things down. But the conventional wisdom says that after 100 years or so of this, one of the caliphs comes along and says, there are too many versions of the Quran. They're all divergent. Burn all of them. We're going to standardize the Bible, the Holy Word, and get the one orthodox position. So the reason there are no books going back is because we burnt them all.
Well, yes. If you read Muslim accounts of the life of the Prophet, and if you read many Western accounts of his life, you get the sense that we know about his life in amazing detail, not just the sort of the broad outline, but we know how he liked to clean his teeth, we know his favourite food, we know the names of all his wives, incredible sort of pointillist detail. The problem with this is that the earliest sources for Muhammad's life, written recognisably by Muslims, is around 800. So that's almost 200 years after his death. We have no life of the Prophet. We have no histories written by Muslims, accounts of the conquests. We have no commentaries on the Quran. And then suddenly around 800, we have this great explosion. So there is a sort of gap. There is a silence. Now, how do you explain that? The traditional account is that the Arabs are an oral culture, and they're passing it down word of mouth, and they've got an amazing memory. But the puzzle again around that is that they have conquered very, very literate and sophisticated societies. And it seems odd that nobody has written anything of this down at all. And I think that the reason that we have no Muslim writings before 800 is that Islam in the form we recognize it doesn't really exist until then. And if you think about it, Islam is not just a religion, it's a civilization. And it's one of incredible sophistication and cultural richness. And I think that it beggars belief that something that sophisticated could have been born fully formed in the lifetime of a single man and could essentially have emerged like lightning from a clear blue sky. Because the problem for a non-believer, someone who does not believe that Muhammad received his revelations from God, is that Islam is recognizably shot through with Jewish and Christian influences. But the whole point of Muhammad's biography is to emphasize that he couldn't have got this from Jews or Christians because, according to Muslim tradition, he is illiterate, he lives in the middle of the desert, and there are no Jewish or Christian communities for him to learn from. And that really is the puzzle.
I must say that Muslims I know talk about Islam as if it's a kind of intersection of faiths, as though they know about Jesus and Mary, and that I'd always assumed that the Quran somehow assumed that the reader was already familiar with older Jewish texts and so on.
And that's absolutely right, because the Quran is an incredibly disputatious text. It's full of arguments between either the Prophet or God himself, speaking to the opponents of Muhammad, who seem to be rejecting his message. And what's really interesting is that far from being pagan, as Muslim tradition implies, these people that the Prophet, or indeed God, speaking to, I mean, it's taken for granted that they know who Abraham is, who Moses is, who Jesus is. These people do not seem to be pagan at all. And the other problem with them is that they don't seem to correspond to other things that we're told about Mecca. They seem to be pastoralists. They keep cattle, they grow vines, they tend olives, none of which could possibly have been grown in Mecca, because Mecca doesn't have any water. It's a very dry spot. And adding to the difficulty of believing that Mecca could possibly have been what Muslim tradition says it was, is the fact that If it was indeed the Dubai of the ancient world, as is so often implied, it's very strange that it's not mentioned at all in any contemporary text until 741, which is over a century after the death of Muhammad. And even then it's located in a desert outside Iraq.
So your argument is that if Muhammad was from anywhere, he wasn't from Mecca, he was from Avdat.
No, I'm not saying it's from Avdat, but I think that he is likely to have come from the region that lay just beyond the desert frontier of Palestine. And you might say, well, why on earth did they shift it? Why did they choose Mecca? Interesting parallel would be with Camelot in the Arthurian myth, that it's a place that floats around and ultimately, you know, various places lay claim to it. Why does Mecca end up being located in the place that it is now? Think of the theology of it. Think about why Mary has to be a virgin in the Christian tradition, because Jesus is God, and if Mary's womb is not virgin, then there's every possibility that Jesus could have a human origin. So likewise, the Quran, if it is not emerging in a pristine wilderness, in a desert, with the sort of the expanse of the sand as a prophylactic all around it, then there is every chance that the Quran might have emerged from these Jewish and Christian heretical traditions, which I think is actually what happened.
You've said that not many scholars would go so far as to doubt the existence of Muhammad. Do you doubt the existence of Muhammad?
I don't. But the fact that there are scholars who doubt him pinpoints the immense range of opinions that there are in this field, and the difficulty really of sort of arriving at any definite solution, because you have some scholars who say that Muhammad was the prophet of God and that we can trust the Muslim sources absolutely. You have others, as you say, who deny that he so much as existed and claim that the Quran emerged in Central Asia. And that range of opinion is very problematic when you're trying to arrive at a sort of consensus. But I'm sure that Muhammad existed because he is mentioned by name by various sort of Christian monks, priests, historians in the 7th century. He's never referred to as a prophet, but he is spoken of as being the leader or the lawgiver or the general of the Arabs. And there is one intriguing document which comes from 634, so that's 2 years after Muhammad is meant to have died, which describes the Arabs attacking Palestine, and they are led by someone who is described as the prophet of the Saracens. And it's hard to know who the prophet of the Saracens could be if not Muhammad. But the reason that that's interesting is that according to Muslim tradition, Muhammad had died 2 years before, and he did not lead the invasion of Palestine. But there are a lot of sort of contemporaneous texts which imply that he was still alive and leading the attack on Palestine. It's like sort of a Rubik's Cube. Every time you think that you've got some facts in a nice line, something comes up to complicate it.
Now, as you make clear, actually, in the documentary, which hasn't been screened here in Australia, Muslim scholars don't accept that you as a non-believer can never hope to understand the truth about the origins of Islam. You just won't get it because you're outside. Because to them, this is not a truth that can be found in the archives. This is a truth which comes from belief. It's yes. Like people say, I know the Lord Jesus Christ in my heart. If you don't know him, that doesn't prove he's not there. You just don't feel it with this revelation that faith gives.
Absolutely. And of course, everything that I'm writing is predicated on my belief that Muhammad was not a prophet of God, and that the Quran is not the word of God, and that we don't need to invoke God to explain what happened. Because I think that if you look at not just the context in Arabia and among the Arabs who conquer this vast empire, but among the Persians and the Romans, the people who are conquered, I think you find the explanation for what happens lies there. And of course, it's the nature of the Muslim texts that they ignore that. They're not really interested in what the Romans and the Persians are up to. But if you look at the Roman and the Persian world, then I think that what happens does not seem so inexplicable.
Mm. Now, just let me summarize the argument then. So your view is that although there is an oral tradition about who Muhammad was and how he received the Quran, and although there are still Bedouin today who maintain that oral tradition, that is not sufficient in itself to establish the point. Because those people, with their oral tradition, came into contact with other people who who you say certainly would have written down the culture that they were being invaded by. They would have made some kind of record of it. So it's that absence on the other side of the frontier.
Yeah, and also, I mean, do you have the phrase Chinese whispers in Australia?
Yeah, sure.
So And I think particularly, you know, these are people who are talking about the most fundamental issue that there is, the destiny of your immortal soul. And so there's an immense pressure to shape what you are memorising and passing down. And
yeah, but what we also have in Australia, Tom, is that we have an Indigenous people, the first Australians, who have a strong oral tradition. And so the historian who comes along and says, I don't believe you because you don't have documentary evidence for what you're saying, and they reply, yes, but I was told this by my father who was told it by his father, that's becoming an increasingly persuasive form of historical knowledge.
But I guess what you don't have in Australia are framing narratives that you can work out what was going on in Australia in 700 AD or 1500 AD. You only have the oral traditions. Whereas with the history of the rise of Islam, you do. Because what you have a lot of texts, a lot of archaeology that explains the world into which Islam is born. And it's a world that is that makes the Middle East now look like a tea party. I mean, a terrible plague had burst out in 541, believed to be bubonic, so probably worse than the Black Death. Perfectly possible that up to a half of the population of the Near East was wiped out. That devastates the tax base and it devastates the reserves of manpower that the Romans and the Persians have. The Romans and Persians then have a terrible war in which for a generation they are hacking each other to pieces. The Persians occupy Palestine and Syria, which had previously been Roman. They get forced out. But when the Romans move back in, it's only a tiny skeleton force. It's like the French or the Dutch moving back into their Asian possessions after the Second World War. And what both the Persians and the Romans have been doing in this war, because they lack the manpower, is to employ Arabs as mercenaries. So there are Arabs already in situ in Iraq and in Syria and in Palestine. And I think ultimately what the Arab conquests are a process of these Arabs finding out, hey, we can just walk in, no one to stop us. And I think that the provinces, I mean, it's like sort of overboiled chicken, the flesh just melts off the bone. But because this is an age where nothing happens that is not to be explained as the will of God, when the Arabs get this vast empire, they find themselves wholly unexpectedly the rulers of this immense array of territories, they have to explain it and they have to say, well, you know, what is God up to? And I think that Muhammad lived. I think that he is indeed, he casts himself as a prophet. I think he does inspire many of the Arabs who go and conquer this empire. I think that his revelations are believed by many of the Arabs to be authentically from God. But I think that there are many other Arab prophets as well. And I think that what really serves to ensure that Muhammad is not forgotten and that what becomes Islam will emerge is the fact that just as Constantine had got behind Christianity, so we have this warlord called Abdul Malik, who is an Arab dynast who seizes control of the Arab Empire. He needs to establish his legitimacy both among the Arabs and in the face of the Romans, who are still a sort of active presence to the north. And how better to do that than to say that you've been chosen by God? Because if you're a leader and you can say that God has chosen you, brilliant. You can do anything you like, basically.
So basically, Constantine's trick. He does it again.
Yeah, so Abdul Malik is basically Constantine and St. Paul rolled into one. Mm. He's the guy who establishes Arabic as the language of the empire, who gets rid of images on Arabic coins, who builds the first recognizably proto-Muslim building, the Dome of the Rock, which is the famous building in Jerusalem with the Golden Dome. And I think that he basically is interested in casting himself as the deputy of God, which in Arabic is Caliphat Allah, the caliph, and that's what it means. And Abdul Malik is in no way saying that, you know, the role of Muhammad is superior to his. He's absolutely casting himself as being on a level with Muhammad. But when he dies, of course, some of the power of that starts to ebb away. And what is also happening is that something is welling up underneath, because the Arabs have conquered a huge number of territories, and that means slaves. And they've brought slaves to these garrison towns that they've built on the edge of Iraq. And these slaves and the descendants of slaves, they get freed, but they start looking at the Quran. And in the Quran, they read that God doesn't like arrogant, swaggering imperialists. He wants, you know, a brotherhood of man. And these slaves and the descendants of slaves start saying, well, hey, what about it? What about us? And they start turning the revelations against their Arab overlords. But they also start doing more, because many of these people are of Jewish, of Christian, of Zoroastrian background. And so they start bringing their traditions to the party. And you can see this starting to change the way that what will become Islam is evolving over the course of the 8th century. So in the Quran, you get the penalty for adultery is that the adulterer will be whipped. But as we know from news reports from Afghanistan, the standard penalty now in Islam for adultery is held to be stoning. Where does this come from? It's not in the Quran. And I think that the answer is that this emphasis on stoning comes from the Old Testament. It comes from the sort of Jewish rabbinical tradition. And it's an embarrassment to Muslim scholars. And, you know, remarkably, they come up with a story that there had been a stoning verse in the Quran, but it got eaten by a goat, which I think is a sort of measure of the challenges that this faces. Likewise, there are Zoroastrians who convert and who bring their traditions. In the Quran, insofar as we can tell, it seems that God wants people to pray three times a day. But Muslims pray five times a day. Why? Well, Zoroastrians prayed five times a day. So I think that they are bringing that tradition. But what they do with this, so it's incredibly creative process. It's authentically multicultural because they are bringing all these various traditions, all these different laws and customs and merging them and putting them together and making something extraordinary and new. But what is distinctive about this process is that they can't admit to what they're doing, because the only way that all these customs will pass into the sort of the bloodstream of this evolving religion is if they can be attributed to Muhammad. So all these Zoroastrian, Jewish, Christian customs, they're not acknowledged to be such. They are attributed to the mouth of the prophet. And these are recorded as sayings, as hadiths. And these together start to form the Sunnah, the sort of the vast body of the sort of the model for how Muslims should behave. And the effect of that is that it starts to undermine the authority of the caliph. And I think that what is key about the success of Islam, as had been the case with Christianity, is that it gives something both for the rulers, you know, the rulers can say that they are, they're chosen one of God, but it also gives something for those who are on the bottom, those who previously had been given no dignity. And I think that what is remarkable about Islam is that it is, in a sense, the revenge of the conquered. It's the most spectacular takeover of a ruling elite by a conquered body of people that history bears witness to.
On RN, this is Books and Arts Daily, and we're at the Adelaide Writers Festival. And Tom Holland is with us, and he's outlining the ideas that he's developed in The Shadow of the Sword, his book about the origins of Islam. Now, the book came out, and it was well received, it was well reviewed. It's yet another success for you as a historian. And then you make this television documentary called Islam, the Untold Story. And after it's screened, Channel 4 receives 1,000 complaints. They go, some go to Channel 4, some go to the Broadcasting Authority, and they cancel a second screening.
Well, no, they didn't. Well, they were going to show a private screening for sort of various movers and shakers.
Well, let me read what Channel 4 said. So Channel 4 spokeswoman said, "Having taken security advice, we have reluctantly cancelled a planned screening of the program Islam, the Untold Story. We made extremely proud of the film, which is still available to view on..." it was available that as a sort of download.
Yeah.
"It's now available..." I know you mustn't say this, but I'm going to say it. "It's available in Australia and probably around the world on Vimeo, which is a service online..."
That's... No, I'm not allowed to say that.
"...a little bit like YouTube, but you can actually watch it." Now, you received threatening messages, did you?
Well, yes, I did, and I wasn't surprised, because we knew that it would cause a lot of upset. I think that there were a lot of Muslims who hadn't even realised that this was an area of academic debate. I think that they sort of leapt to the presumption that what I was saying could only be explained by the fact that I was either very stupid or very malicious, and neither of them were particularly flattering. Of course, they were angry, and they fired off tweets and emails and all kinds of things. But I think that ultimately, that doesn't tell us anything, really, about, you know, the nature of Islam or anything like that, sort of clash of civilizations. What it tells us about is that there are a lot of sort of very intemperate people on Twitter, but we already know that. You know, it's the condition of Twitter that every so often, I mean, like, sort of... You know, chaos theory kicks in and people get incredibly cross and they all have a go at someone and then they move on.
It also tells us something about the nature of history on television, because you've written a very nuanced book, but television requires a rather more direct approach. You've got to make your claims bolder when you go on television. Did you feel a pressure to be more insistent about a position than you'd been in the book?
The film was made by a brilliant director who's won many, many awards, and that's why I went with him. And I essentially gave him the book and said, make of the film what you will. And what he did was to put me as a character within the film. So most history documentaries involve a bloke or a woman wandering around, you know, a pile of stones, and he will then say, this happened here, this happened there, and you're essentially giving a lecture. We absolutely didn't want to do that, because the point that we were trying to make was that ultimately I don't think that we can know for certain what happened. And so people's theories and ideas about what happened will reflect the background that they come from. So the film was about the limits of what we can know, and it was about the difference of perspective that is bound to exist between a secular non-Muslim perspective and the more traditionalist Muslim perspective. And that's a sort of challenging thing to do in history, because history documentaries, because people want definite answers.
Well, but it's a challenging thing to do on television, because the grammar of television tends to be, you've heard the myths, tonight we reveal the truth. You know, you think about Bethany Hughes with Helen of Troy. Yeah. So Helen of Troy, woman of myth, tonight we go in search of the real Helen of Troy.
Yeah, well, we're sort of doing the reverse of that, because traditionally that kind of film about the ancient world involves you saying, you thought she was a myth, in fact she was real. And we were doing the other way around. We were saying, you think it's real, actually it probably wasn't.
Yes.
And that is more challenging, I think.
The other key element of television history, I've noticed, is that someone somewhere, the television gods, require that when you're a television historian looking at a camera, at some stage you must say the words, at that point, the world changed, pause, forever.
But do you know what? Do you know what? On this occasion, it did.
You see, the insight came to me while I was watching the documentary on Vimeo. I thought, yes, this is almost as though he's about to say the world changed forever, and then you turned to the camera and you said, it is 5 minutes to midnight and the ancient world is about to change forever.
But I should emphasise, it then goes to a beautiful shot of a high moon over a desert. So it's...
It's very
classy.
Now, I've tried to find out by ringing around the networks whether there are any plans to screen this in Australia. I haven't found anyone saying yes. Do you know if there are plans to screen this in Australia?
I don't, but, you know, keep hassling your contacts in Australian TV.
Are you inclined to see religions, the religions of the world, in their diversity, you know, with many gods, having a trajectory towards monotheism?
Well, certainly in Europe and the Middle East, but not beyond. I mean, I was recently in India, and looking at the cities in northern India with mosques and with churches, but also, of course, with the extraordinary array of temples to Hindu gods, it made me think of a Mediterranean world in which Constantine had never converted, and in which the gods of the Greeks and the Romans and the Syrians continued to be worshipped. I think that, as I say, it's helpful to think of Judaism and Christianity and Islam as being part of a single extraordinary revolution. And I think it's the measure of its success that it did wipe out so many of the earlier religious traditions. But in that light, I think it's sort of helpful to think perhaps of medieval and early modern history, not in terms of clash of civilizations, in terms of Christendom against the world of Islam, but the way in which Christendom and Islam together constitute a single civilization, so that from the Atlantic coast of Portugal right the way up to the walls of China, you have people who have the same prophets, who know the names of the angels. They're ultimately coming from the same melting pot. And I think that in an age where Jews and Christians and Muslims have been thrown together far more than they were before, and in which so much of the language is oppositional, it's emphasizing the difference. I think that there is incredible value in looking back at the beginnings of all these faiths and recognizing that they are all products essentially of the same milieu.
Can I ask you again the question I asked you at the start, and that is, have you reflected then on what it is that drives people to search for this system of belief, or to create these systems of belief?
Well, it's human nature that you search for answers, and of course every civilization has its gods, has its belief that there is something that lies beyond humanity. I think that what monotheism does that the earlier religions had not done is to give value to the individual. If you think about the Assyrians impaling people, you think about the Spartans, their almost Nazi attitude towards eugenics, you think about the Romans watching criminals tearing themselves to pieces for fun, there's a callousness there that is kind of innocent. They're not aware particularly that they're being callous. What happens with Christianity and with Islam is that that perspective changes. And although, of course, Christians and Muslims are responsible for terrible atrocities, they are always aware that they are atrocities. That sort of innocent enthusiasm for slaughtering an enormous number of people that the Romans of Caesar's age had has gone. And I think that, you know, if you look at ancient cities, say, in the Near East, and you're trying to trace the development of Christianity in the Roman Empire, what you start noticing after Constantine's conversion is that strange new buildings are appearing that had never been in cities before. Orphanages, hospitals, old people's homes. These just didn't exist previously. And I think that that is the reflection of the fact that ordinary people are being given a value.
But why would monotheism give ordinary people a value? Why would many gods make you more callous?
Because I think the underlying principle in, say, in Christianity and then in Islam is that all humans are essentially equal before God. There is a single God. He has made the whole of humanity. And perforce, that gives a kind of dignity to the slave as well as to the emperor.
This is Books and Arts Daily on RN. I'm Michael Cathcart. We're at Adelaide Writers' Week, and I'm talking to the historian Tom Holland. Tom, let's talk about historical method. You represent historical method in your debate with the Islamic scholars as a kind of enlightened scepticism, as if you approach your subject almost coldly, demanding to be convinced, but show me the evidence. Where is the evidence? You tell me your stories, but I want to see the documentation. An historian can also think of himself as an anthropologist, trying to get under the skin of his or her subjects, trying to understand how they think. And some historians make that their story. And in your earlier books, I felt that you were more inclined to be like that, getting into the mind of the Greeks, the mind of the Persians. Whereas in this project, I felt you sort of standing back and taking a distance and saying, show me the paperwork.
Well, I think that there are periods in ancient history that are very well documented, relatively, and then there are periods that are not. And the difficulty for a historian writing about ancient history is, what do you do with those areas where you simply don't have the source material? The earlier books, The Fall of the Roman Republic, the Great War between the Greeks and the Persians, we have quite a lot of source material for both of those. And that's why I chose those periods, because I knew that there would be enough documentary evidence that I wouldn't have to endlessly point out how little we know. In a sense, with this story, the appeal was the opposite, because it seems to be a story that we know very well, but actually I don't think that we know it as well as we think we do. But you're right. I mean, I hope that I haven't just been sort of negatively sceptical in the book. It's a book in which I am, like, you know, I'm trying to get into the minds of caliphs and Roman emperors, but also of Christian holy men who stand on pillars in the Syrian desert for 20 years as their legs get ulcerous and worms crawl through their groin, and yet they stand there. And you can't read about that and not think, well, what are they up to? What are they doing? And I try and represent it not in a sort of sneery, mocking way, but in a way that is absolutely empathetic, and I hope that I'm absolutely empathetic as well when it comes to what I see as being the extraordinary achievement of the Muslim scholars in the 8th century who essentially fashion this amazing new religion. So I hope that it's not just sort of reductively sceptical.
Yeah, well, I wasn't implying it was reductively sceptical, but I was implying that there was a difference in your orientation.
I think it's down to the fact that if you're writing about the Roman Republic, say, we have letters in which, you know, we know what the weather was like on a certain day. We know that, that some bloke has a room in which a crack has appeared. We have a level of detail that, for an by the standards of most ancient history, is absolutely extraordinary. But the thing about the 7th century is absolutely the fact that, that in crucial areas, we do not have this kind of detail.
You know when I felt the difference? It was actually watching the documentary, and there's a sequence where you're in Istanbul and you visit the neglected ruins of the Roman emperors of Constantinople. You seem to be in somebody's backyard.
We are in someone's backyard.
And Istanbul is kind of going on indifferent to the fact that you're in this place that means something to you. You sort of shed a scholarly tear over this place while Istanbul goes on
it's
indifferent.
It's the palace of the Caesars. Of course. I was it? Welling up.
You were. It was a very beautiful moment. I was there with you all the way. I guess another way of looking at this is to say that historians sometimes are struck by the strangeness of the past. We go back and think, gosh, those Victorians were unusual types, weren't they? Mm. They thought about death the way we think about sex, or some premise like that. And other times you go back and you say, gosh, isn't the past like the present? And the best historians seem to be able to negotiate both, get the sort of continuities with the past and the differences.
And that's the fascination, particularly of ancient history, as I was saying, that it is both familiar and strange. And really, it's a bit like those sort of visual images where you're either looking at a rabbit or a duck. Can it be both simultaneously? I suppose it can, but it depends on your perspective. So going to the Palace of the Caesars, I felt I'm standing in what was a cockpit of great affairs. I describe it as being the White House and the Pentagon and the Supreme Court all rolled into one. And of course, there is this incredible sense of vanished glory, because literally all there is that remains of this vast spreading palace of the Caesars of Constantinople is a wall in a man's garden. And there are sort of discarded beds everywhere and cats sitting there. And I mean, it really is very, very sort of powerful. But equally, the other place that we visited in the course of filming was the Dome of the Rock, which was this extraordinarily beautiful monument raised on the site of the old Jewish temple. Unbelievably spiritually potent place. And most non-Muslims are not generally allowed in, but we got special clearance to go in. And you walk in there and you touch the rock that had been the Holy of Holies, in which in Muslim tradition Muhammad had prayed there before being taken up to heaven. And it is hard not to feel that you are in some kind of nuclear reactor, that the sense of power radiating out of it is almost palpable. And I suppose there, rather than feeling how distant the past was, I felt, wow, it's really close.
But that goes to the power of religion, doesn't it?
It does, but religion is coming out of antiquity. So when we experience the power of religion, we are experiencing the influence and the legacy of antiquity.
Mm. I was reflecting on this with the resignation of the Pope, because I thought, I was brought up in the Protestant tradition, and yet even I would think of the Pope as someone who has been somehow transformed into a different kind of person because he's become Pope, and that you can sort of unbecome Pope.
But I think that that's the perfect demonstration that it's the nature of religions that they tell us, whether we are believers or skeptics, that they've basically always been the same. But they haven't. I mean, you can believe that God perhaps is manifesting himself through them, but essentially they are products of human civilization and evolution. And just as Islam evolved over the centuries, so likewise did notions of the papacy. Popes have resigned before, as Benedict well knew, because he's the Pope and he's a scholar and he'd know that. And I think that he is well aware that the papacy is not a static phenomenon. And you could almost argue that religions need to evolve if they're to survive.
Yes, well, you're only going to look at the way Christianity worked in colonial Australia and compare it with the way Christianity works today to see that it's not the same religion, that even if we were practicing Christians going back, we might not be quite comfortable in the churches of 100 years ago.
Well, yes, and you see, that's really interesting, because one of the reasons why both Christianity and Islam have been so effective is that they do provide a license for conquest. If you're a Christian and you look at the book of Joshua and you think of you cast yourself as an Israelite who's been given the promised land, then that does sort of give you a license to go and grab stuff. And that has obviously underlies an awful lot of European expansion. And I suppose really that it had its sort of death rattle with apartheid. I mean, I imagine that put paid to that tradition for good. I don't think Christians in the future will be using the Book of Joshua in that way. But for a very long, you know, for hundreds and hundreds of years, that's the use that it's been put to.
I saw an American program on a right-wing cable show, and I think the program was called Jihad Watch. And you were held up as a sort of paragon of what the Muslims are doing to people like you. And the guy was on there saying, and the guy's left wing, you know. and he's a victim of this stuff.
Yeah, when you got friends like that, who needs enemies?
Yeah. Now, we've been talking about history, but you've also written historical novels, six historical novels, and they often include a dimension of horror.
And supernatural, because as you can tell from my discussion of religion, I'm very, very interested in the way that different people in different periods have really sort of interpreted the fantastical and the supernatural. And so, yes, I have to put my hands up and confess that I began my writing career as a vampire writer.
The vampire, this is the title, the vampire being the true pilgrimage of George Gordon, the sixth Lord Byron.
Byron was a vampire. This
no,
was the
was
argument
not.
Of the book, and by the end I'd almost convinced myself.
So what's next for you?
Well, to be honest, I've had enough of gods that people still believe in, because it's quite stressful, and I've had sort of almost 8 or 9 years of thinking about both Christianity and Islam. And so what I really want to do is to get back to a world where people worship gods that are no longer around. And I also want to have a bit of spice, a bit of naughtiness. So I'm doing
remember,
a sequel.
You're a national
I'm
radio.
Not going to, I remembered that just in time. So I'm going to do a sequel to my first book, which was about the collapse of the Roman Republic, the rise and then the murder of Julius Caesar. And I'm going to write about how, on the ruins of the Roman Republic, Augustus Caesar establishes an autocracy and a dynasty. And I will trace the history of that dynasty from Augustus through to Nero. And so that will enable me to write not just about Nero, but about Caligula as well. And I'm sort of regarding writing about Caligula as my treat that I've awarded myself after years and years of pondering Talmudic scholarship and negotiating the shoals of Islamic revisionism.
Well, what fun. There was one thing I wanted to ask you about just as we wind up. Late last year, a Harvard academic named Karen King published a fragment of a papyrus known as the Gospel of Jesus' Wife. She said it was a newly discovered fragment. And it tells a story in which Jesus refers to his wife. What did you make of that discovery?
Well, I'd been tipped off that it was almost certainly a fake by a friend who was a New Testament scholar. And I think that is what it has turned out to be. But I also think that even if it is not a fake, what it tells us about, in that case, is what Christians in, I think it was dated to the sort of late second century, so what Christians 200 years after the life of Jesus thought Jesus had been. It tells us nothing about the historical Jesus. Even if it's true, it doesn't tell us that Jesus had a wife. It tells us that certain Christians at that period needed him to have had a wife. And of course, as I mentioned, the earliest sources that we have that give us the life of Muhammad date to 200 years after his life. And again, I think that what we have to remember is that what we read in these lives of Muhammad, and the aim of the people who are writing them is not to tell us what the historical Muhammad did. It is to provide the faithful with signposts to eternity, to heaven. So what we get in the biographies of Muhammad, what we get in the late Gospels that give us details about Jesus having an affair with Mary Magdalene or whatever, this is not telling us anything. And Dan Brown, you know, I'm sorry, but...
And that's where we must stop. Would you thank Tom Holland? Tom Holland's book is called In the Shadow of the Sword. It's published by Little Brown. His TV documentary is called Islam, The Untold Story, and you can find it online at the video website Vimeo. Don't be confused by the documentary on YouTube, which purports to be this film. It's another documentary that's been wrongly labelled. On RN, I'm Michael Cathcart, saying goodbye from Adelaide Writers' Week. More books and arts tomorrow across Australia. This is RN, where the news is next, and then Bush Telegraph.
G'day, Mike and Jesse here with a brand new podcast for you.
It's called Long Story Short, real life Australian stories.
I don't know anyone in town, and the problem is they don't know me.
Meet remarkable characters.
He said, yes, of course I murdered him. I murdered him and cut him up and buried him in the sale yards.
Yeah,
they'll share their experiences.
We're not going anywhere in this country. We're here permanently. This is a good fight.
You can download or stream Long Story Short with me, Mike.
And me, Jesse, from the RN website.